The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday evening California time space show program. And I am David Livingston, your host. Thank you very much for tuning in. And this is our first April 2019 program. So we're glad you're on board. And we have one of our favorite guests on board who I will introduce again in just a moment. I will say that Rod Pyle is by far and away the most prolific space book author we have ever had the opportunity to talk to on the Space Show. But I'll say more about that when I introduce Rod. But he is a nonstop author machine of incredible books. I hope you're reading them, especially after we highlight them on the Space Show. But for tonight, if you want to call and talk to Rod Pyle, it is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, and you can talk for on any topic you want, but hopefully on the topics that Rod is talking about. And be patient, because we may answer the phone and you may have to sit for a couple of minutes before we're able to bring you up on air. You can also do email for us, and that is drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can post on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for upcoming shows. And click on the first show listed, that is Rod Pyle Show. And then blog comments are all the way down at the bottom. As soon as you send your blog comment or question, I will get it and I can integrate it into tonight's program. But the phone is our preferred way. We really do hope that we can get toll-free calls rather than emails. 1-866-687-7223. While you're at the Space Show website, thespaceshow.com, do check out our fully detailed website newsletter for the week, and also look at our upcoming events, because we're almost completely filled for second quarter 2019. Remember, everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily and rapidly download the shows. We do have a store if you're interested in logo wear, t-shirts, and things of like that nature. The best way to access it is to click on any pictures on the right of any and all website pages of Pepper, the adorable little Siberian Husky, listening to the Space Show. And that will take you to our Cafe Press page for Space Show logo wear. And take a look, and lots of different things are offered, and we hope you find what you're looking for, and your comments are always, always welcome. The most important thing for me always is supporting the Space Show. So remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 listener-supported program. And that means that you, the listener, keep us on the air with your contributions. And we really appreciate them, and they are much needed. So remember, as a nonprofit 501c3, you get a tax deduction if you're paying U.S. federal taxes. That might be on your mind about this time of year. If you're lucky to pay California taxes, we're a public benefit corporation. You get a tax deduction in California for your gift as well. Our nonprofit parent is 1onegiantleapfoundation.org. Do check it out. And if you're interested in being on our Space Show advisory board, then when you're at 1giantleapfoundation.org, check the left menu for Teams. And then on the drop-down menu, when you click on that, you'll see advisory board. So read the guidelines, see who's already signed up to be on the advisory board. And if you're interested, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Also remember, if you buy a lot of stuff from Amazon, they support the Space Show. And if you click on the big Amazon link in the middle of our homepage, then you will see what our two nonprofit programs are with Amazon. Also, you'll see Support the Space Show over on the right of the homepage, and that tells you how to make a PayPal contribution or to mail a check to us. So we appreciate your support. It is needed, and we're very, very thankful to all of you who do support us and who will be supporting us. We do also have sponsors, so remember they get that banner ad going across the homepage, which you see, and they rotate across the homepage. You can change your banner whenever you want. And also on full-length shows, which is tonight, I read a short blurb from our various sponsors. So for the first segment tonight, Moonwords is a sponsor. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit Moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. The Space Foundation sponsors us, and their symposium is next week, everybody, April 8th through the 11th. And it is in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel. Not too late to register and to go. You might have to stay in a Colorado Springs hotel rather than the Broadmoor. But check it all out at spacesymposium.org. Connect, engage, and get business done all in one place. It is a unique event, and if you've never been to one, you need to be at one. Networking like you've never seen before. Northrop Grumman sponsors us. They're a leading global security company, providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for both the government and the private sector on a global basis, not just a U.S. basis. And they have capabilities that go from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. So you definitely want to check them out, too. And then, in addition, AIAA sponsors us. And this is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have five forums or conferences a year, and they have networking to die for and a repository library of thousands of peer-reviewed papers that you can access. You don't have to be an engineer to be a member of AIAA. The networking is very, very high quality. You're meeting the people who are working and shaping the future of aerospace every single day. So check it all out at AIAA.org. And as I said a few minutes ago, Rod Pyle is back with us. He has written extensively on the U.S. space program. He works as a writer for JPL and as a frequent speaker at science and tech conferences. In fact, he was just at one in Iowa. He has researched the Apollo landing extensively and has created an experimental learning program based on the leadership and management. I'm mentioning Apollo because we're talking two books tonight. His book, First on the Moon, The Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, broke today. And today is the first day that it is available. And the next book that we're going to talk about, probably for a larger part of the show, is a really, really cool book. And it's called Space 2.0, How Private Space Flight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. But first, congratulations on First on the Moon breaking today. How are you, Rod?
I'm good. Thank you very much. And it was a relief to get it out. I've got one more coming this year, and then I'm going to rest for a while, I think, in the magazine.
What is the one more?
I wish I could cue the reverb. I don't have it on my phone, but Heroes of the Space Age, which is published by Prometheus, and is exactly what it sounds like. It's seven or eight chapters of the people that I thought were pivotal in the first space age, and that, of course, is, you know, if you want to get an argument going in a pro-space group or a bunch of Apollo fans, you know, that's like rolling a hand grenade in the lunchroom, right? Say, okay, who are the big heroes? Who are the figures here? So some you expect, some you might not.
Okay, well, we'll wait until that comes out. When does it come out?
I think May.
Oh, that's just around the corner.
Yeah, it was a busy year last year. I don't recommend it.
Well,
but I tell you, you know, I have admiration for you just being able to work through the Amazon affiliate program sign up to get that going with your website, because I tried to do that twice in the last couple of years, and I kept getting to the point where I thought, I'm just not sure this is worth it. It's an awful lot procedure to go through.
We did it years ago when the program first started. Remember, the space show's coming up almost on 20 years, 19 years actually, but we'll just call it 20. And we did it when the Amazon program first started, and it was really, really simple. And then we got grandfathered in, and occasionally they would send a note and say, if you want to continue with this program, provide the following. So you had to give them our tax ID number. We had to give them the code on our IRS letter for the 501c3 because one of the programs is a nonprofit only program to get listed as an Amazon nonprofit. And it's worked really smoothly, and there are some listeners who do use the program. Unfortunately, it's only for Amazon products. So if you buy, let's say you buy books, and I buy your book from one of their retailers, but not from Amazon.
Right.
The discount doesn't hold. Or let's say I buy household products. I buy a lot of household products. And it may say serviced by Amazon, but it's from an independent retailer. You don't get the discounts on that. So it's only on Amazon itself products. And I wish it were broader than that, but I can understand the others are not getting a big cut from Amazon to begin with. I've heard authors complain about that a lot with their books, and you could probably shed light on that, but that would take us away from talking about First on the Moon.
Yeah, and those are self-published people or people that have some control over their fate in the marketplace. I've only worked for traditional publishers, so it's a little bit of a mystery to me. I've read about it, and I've heard from people, but not positive. Not positive how it works.
So because this is the 50th year of Apollo, there are no shortage of Apollo books, as you and were talking before this show started.
Yeah.
So tell us about yours. Why, first of all, yours is a big format book, and it's all glossy, tons and tons and tons of really cool pages. But what's so special about First on the Moon?
Well, and that was the question that faced me a couple of years ago when the topic came up. This is actually the kind of commission that authors, traditionally published authors, love to get, because the publisher called me and said, hey, do you want to do an Apollo book? We'll pay you. And I thought, yes. Why can't it be like this all the time? This is wonderful. This is Sterling, which is, they own Barnes & Noble, or owned by Barnes & Noble, I forget which. And so, you know, we had to talk about how to come up with something different. This is the third or fourth Apollo book I had done. I didn't realize at the time that the other one from 2005 and one from 2010, were going to get reissued. I probably should have thought of that. So actually all three of them are on the shelf this year, but only one is actually brand new. So, you know, I scratched my head, thought about it, and thought, you know, what I didn't want to get into was the kind of thing we used to do with the History Channel, which is, you know, sexy secrets of the space program and Apollo 11 or something like that. I mean, you see those things all the time on television. So I thought, okay, we're staying away from that kind of sensationalistic stuff as much as possible, although there's always a little bit of that that creeps into the marketing language on the cover and stuff. But really, I just wanted to give a fun, engaging narrative for motivated readers. You know, there's a few tidbits in there that really seasoned space fans will find and enjoy. But for people kind of to step back from that, more of a slightly more general audience, to kind of remind them of what we did, why it was so sensational, and why it's still difficult to do it again, and look a little bit at the characters of these three guys that went to the moon, Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. And especially, one thing I really, really wanted to do was talk to the kids. So I was able to get Rick Armstrong and Andy Aldrin to spend some time with me. And so that was probably, for me, that was the biggest treat, because they're both people I knew. I knew Andy better than Rick. Both really nice guys. And, you know, what question are you going to ask? I mean, part of it has to be, well, what was it like when your dad was on the moon? but Andy gave me, I think, the best answer I'd ever heard for a question like that in my life. So that alone made it a real treat to do.
Do you want to tell us what he said, or do we have to buy the book and read it?
No, I'll tell you. So we serve on a board together for Tau Zero Foundation, and we work together with National Space Society and stuff, so I kind of knew him. So we were talking for, about an hour and a half. And towards the end of the conversation, you know, that point where you always say, if you're interviewing somebody or something like this, say, you got anything else? You know, any final comments? And usually they say, nah, I think that's about it. And he said, yeah, I'm going to tell you something I've never told another writer. And I thought, oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, here, I'm getting out my checkbook right now. And the condensed version is, he said, you know, here I am, this teen or preteen, watching my dad on the moon. And I'm not worried about his safety because I trust NASA. They're this amazing organization, with incredible people that always get it right. This is 1969, you know, different time. And I have full confidence in the program. And I'm not worried that he's going to get hurt. I'm not worried that anything is going to go wrong. He said I was watching him as he was kind of hopping across the moon, wondering what people were thinking about that, because I knew just by watching him, from knowing my dad, that he was doing that study soil dynamics as his feet came down the surface, as he watched the dust and the particles move away from his feet in no atmosphere and in lower gravity. They talked about that for a minute, and he said, but the one thing that did terrify me was I was looking at this cable between the lunar module and the TV camera, thinking, if he trips over that, messes up that experiment, I'm going to have to go back and see my friends in school when school starts again, and that's going to be really, really, really embarrassing, and that's the worst thing that could happen right now. And I just thought that was so hilarious. And yet it makes sense. You know, when you think of teenage kids, that's the way we thought when we were that age. But I never would have expected it in that situation, so that was really fun.
Was he the only one of Buzz's kids that you talked to?
Yeah. And same with Armstrong. I just talked to Rick.
Yeah. The book is already out, or expect it soon? I mean, how when you say it was released today, does that mean the bookstores already have it?
It came out on Amazon at midnight, so it was sitting in the warehouse getting ready for the release date, which is set, I think, by the publisher. And then it should be in retail channels either today or the next few days, depending on how far it's got to ship and the size of the bookstore, but definitely by the end of the week, where it will join a few other Apollo books that we were discussing before airtime, because it's that year, and I knew there was going to be a bunch, so I tried to do, you know, I tried to do something a little different, but really, it's like walking through a minefield that's all mines or very little dirt, you know, there's just so much density there, it's really hard for us not to overlap each other. There are a few that I've seen that really are kind of unique and look like things that I really want to read, but there's an awful lot of stuff that's just kind of a general retelling, so that's something you try to avoid.
You mentioned kids, so is this a book suitable for kids, and what age do you think?
You know, it's funny, when you talk about audience age, because we always, the publishers and I always discuss this before we start, and for a general book like this, if it's an adult book, quote-unquote, you know, for the broader retail market, they generally will tell you to write for about a 10th grade to 11th grade level, unless it's a technical book. If it's a business book, they will tell you to write for a 7th grade level with short declarative sentences and short paragraphs and lots of white space, because a lot of people, I guess, you know, they pick it up at the airport and they want a quick, easy read as they're crossing the country. And so I'd say this is like young teen up. You know, there's nothing terribly challenging in it, and there's an awful lot of photographs that really scoured. I mean, like a lot of people in my position, I've been collecting these pictures either online or physical copies that I scanned or by going to the archives, where I used to spend a lot of time when you still had to do that, first in D.C. and then in Maryland, gathering all that material and trying to really find something that hasn't been used to death. And as I'm sure you know, a couple of years ago, I think it was 2015, they did that large release of stuff that had just been sitting there for an awful long time. It wasn't like it was a secret. It was just, if you went to the National Archives and were digging through books, boxes of Apollo images, you found a lot of stuff that was a crooked shot of somebody's boot or the sun or a piece of a photo montage or just a shot of a crater, because it was interesting from a science standpoint, but not something people wanted to see. And decades ago, NASA culture and got all the very coolest stuff out of there, and that's what hit the magazines and the books. A couple of years ago, they did a much larger release of that material, but the trick was you had to be pretty good with Photoshop to composite it well. So I hired a guy to do a new pass on a bunch of that stuff, so that's, you know, it's not exactly never before seen, but my version of it's never before seen, so I'll pat myself on the shoulder for that. How's that?
Listeners, it's all the pages are glossy, and there is a photograph or a technical chart, and yes, there are technical diagrams and charts in the book, but almost every page has a color photo on it. So for those of you who like to read books by looking at pictures, this is made in heaven for you, or made on the moon for you, I should say, because it's incredibly high quality, and the publisher sprung for first-class printing. That there's no doubt about that.
Well, and I have to say, when I saw it, I was surprised to see if they had done the embossed titling on the cover, because that's something you kind of have to beg for these days. What I haven't seen is the Kindle version, which, you know, you always kind of grind your teeth a little bit before you see it in Kindle, because not all Kindle books are created equal. But the last couple I've seen look pretty good, so I look forward to seeing this, how this looks on Kindle as well.
It also appears to me that the writing, First on the Moon, is in a shade and done in red, but it almost looks to me like it kind of glows and stands out. So I don't know if it is a special kind of ink like that, but it doesn't look just like flat ink, even though I know it's embossed a little bit. But it looks like it's got some kind of 3D or some kind of standout capability that really, really grabs you.
Yeah, and I think for both that and the Space 2.0 book, I was really thrilled with, as you've already kind of pointed out, the extra effort they went through, because it's so expensive to do this anymore. And for years, when they were making that transition from printing domestically or in Europe to Asia, specifically mostly in China, we were having problems with quality control, because pages might be upside down or off axis or what have you. And it was hard to get the extra goodies done overseas without having to actually have a representative there to stand by the printing press to make sure everything was going well. And obviously that's no longer the case. So I think just about all these things are printed in either China or adjoining countries these days, but they've really upped their game, and the end result is just beautiful.
How do you protect the copyright if it's printed in China or one of these other countries that don't pay attention to copyrights, or do you just not worry about it?
You really can't. I mean, this one and Space 2.0 were both actually licensed in China. I think this one was licensed in traditional Mandarin, which means it's going to primarily to other markets like Singapore and Taiwan and so forth. 2.0 was licensed, I think, in both traditional and simplified Mandarin, which means it's going to the mainland. And, you know, you worry about ever seeing the proceeds from that, but at the same time, you know as well as I, all somebody's got to do is cut the spine off the book and do a scan of each page, and it's going to get put up as a PDF anyway, and we see them all the time. So at a certain point, you just kind of shrug and say, oh, I guess that's part of the bigger PR plan. You know, maybe somebody will see a crummy copy of it online, decide they want it in paper.
Is there anything we should know about First on the Moon that we haven't mentioned or that you would like to point out before we turn to Space 2.0?
I think I really tried to find a good balance between the people and the personalities and what they were going through and the hardware, because you really can't talk about the space race and the Apollo program without talking about the hardware. And one of my weaknesses is if you said, hey, write 300 pages about the development of the F1 engine, I'd go sit in a corner like a hobgoblin and happily do that for the next 6 months and do just that. So I was reminded a couple of times by people that I was working with saying, you know, don't forget to give equal time to the human beings, because that's a big part of it. And actually that ended up being a much larger part of the story, because it was the people. I mean, the machines are made by people. They're designed by people. You talk about the F1 engine and this kind of blend of art and engineering that went into the early development cycle to try and keep them from exploding because of that harmonic instability. Or you talk about Tom Kelly and the lunar module and, you know, what a touch-and-go process that was, just trying to get one more gram off of one more part and the machine is shaving these things as tiny and as thin as they could, right up to the point that they would break under stress, and then they'd back off a little bit and make one more. Both the lunar module and the command module, the machinists down the shop floor making parts by the time they finished had already been obsoleted because somebody had drafted up a new version of it. So all these amazing little stories that you try and weave in there while you're telling this tale is just what makes it so much fun. So I think if it's different, that's it, is that it's a general read on these very specific topics. So I don't get too bogged down in technical detail, but I also didn't want to just do yet another long encyclopedic listing of the chronology of the mission, because we've seen plenty of those and we'll see more.
Listeners, we're going to move, Rod, to Space 2.0. Also has a foreword by Buzz. The full title is Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. And this has a series of testimonial statements on the front cover by John Logsdon, but on the back cover by Greg Autry, who will soon be back on the space show, Stephen Moran, let's see, Howard Bloom got his 2 cents in, Dan Rasky from NASA, Roger Lania. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It is really a great book, and I have it. Thank God I have a copy on the desk. It's autographed by Ling Ling. And it's an unconventional book, but it's, you ought to have it, because it will really summarize and bring you current on what's been happening in the new space industry and the space efforts that we talk about all the time on the space show. How long have you been working? Did you have to work on this book, Rod?
That book, I think, so you were very helpful in the creation of this, so I appreciate that, and I thank you. So I think we talked in 2016, and at that point, I had been working on the process of writing it for a year and a half, and had been pitching it since probably 2014, if I got my math right. So it was quite a long haul. It was almost 5 years. And part of that was because I knew I wanted to interview a bunch of people in the field that were very smart, yourself included, and a number of space agency leaders and people from foreign space agencies and people from the commercial space companies here in the U.S. and the smaller outfits and so forth. And part of it was just that it was kind of untrodden territory for me, and had a lot more policy in it than I'd been used to writing about. So I really wanted to get it right. Kind of entertaining that by the time I got done, I was about 40% over the page count, so I sheepishly turned in my manuscript and said, it's a little long, and they said, a little? And they're really nice people. I mean, they weren't gruff or anything, but it's like, that's a little too much. So we had to do a lot of pruning to get it down to size. They still let me go a little further than we'd planned the page count. But we wanted to keep it a very approachable sort of introduction to the new space age and what's ahead in the next 20 to 25 years. So I had to put some kind of a cap on that period of time so that we just didn't get lost in it. And finally was able to triage it, whip it into shape. But it was definitely the hardest book I've ever done by a factor of about 5.
So one of the things I found interesting, I mean, all of it is really interesting, because I talk about all of this, but I don't get to see it in sort of summarized, detailed perspective of, because the shows are sort of individual standalone, and I have not yet put them all together where you have it all put together. So it's very interesting for me to read about what we talk about here on the space show over the year. But you attempt, and you do a very good job at it, in Chapter 3, to respond to people asking you, why space? So I have to tell you, this is a question that comes up all the time on the space show from new listeners. And if I had to list the number of really good answers I've gotten over the last 19 years, it would probably be maybe on one hand, maybe fewer than one hand. It's not an easy question to answer. especially for someone who's not knowledgeable, is not a space cadet, doesn't know what space is doing or providing or how our society functions on it, and sees it more or less as a deep hole where money is going, and they think that money should go to their premier program or topic or handicap program or whatever it may be. How do you answer, how did you answer why space? And you sort of did this with interviews that you were doing. So were the people that were asking you the question, were they happy or satisfied with your answer? Or they just say, oh, okay, thanks, and move on, and you really didn't answer it for them?
Well, I kind of came at it from a couple of different angles. So part of it was setting up a scenario, which is kind of an amalgam of a bunch of radio interviews I'd done over the years, which is, I know, I mean, you've been in that seat for decades, so you know the story well, when you get somebody calling in saying, you know, really, why are we doing this? What's the point? Give me something tangible for me. You know, don't tell me about the benefits for broader humanity and our bright future and the children and my children and all that. What's in it for me? And that's a hard one. And especially if you're doing, I do AM overnight radio in Chicago every few weeks, and we get those calls because it's late night AM radio. So you'll get some long haul trucker across the Midwest somewhere. And he said, and you know, they're very nice about it. They say not to be impolite, but really, what's the point? I think it's cool and all that, but tell me, if I got to tell my teenage son why this is important, tell me why. And as you pointed out, I mean, it would be the height of hubris for me to think that I've got the answer, and I don't, because NASA's been trying to answer that question since 1958 in one way or another, and struggles with it. I mean, we've all seen the publication spinoffs that they've been doing since the Apollo year, and it's a good magazine, and it does tell you about some interesting things that are coming out of the program, but I think it kind of misses the mark because it's talking to the brain and not the heart, and you have to find a way to do both. And there is that broader philosophical answer, which we've heard a million times, of, you know, mankind must explore and we want to go beyond the horizon over the next hill and all that. I don't think that gets a lot of traction anymore. The nice thing about the new space age, which in my opinion we're in the middle of and have been on the leading edge of for quite some time, is there's gold in those hills. And that's one that people can really relate to. And even if it's not them directly, we're not all Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and Richard Branson, and people that are hopefully going to start turning a profit on this pretty soon. But investing in those enterprises is going to start turning a profit for people if they're the right picks in the next 5 to 10 years. And that's something that we've seen over and over and over again as a really powerful motivator. Offshore, I think, still much more than here. National pride is a huge one, and you and I talked about this quite a bit when I was interviewing you for the book. We were talking about China and the nationalism that's behind it, and it's not something that's a secret. I mean, we both read that 2016 white paper they put out about their space program, and it was very clear what parts of it that I believe completely were very clear about, you know, we're doing this for prestige and for the national good. And I just would close that thought by saying, when you're talking about national good, national goals like that, it's really hard to escape, no matter how many people try and tamp down this answer. When you look at the returns we got in the Apollo program, the well-trodden road, still the best figure I've seen, the most accurate one, I think anyway, is about $14 out for every dollar in, and a couple of generations, including kids that are growing up now, that were so inspired by that, they went off and did the hard work and did education and STEM programs, math and science and technology and engineering and so forth, and entered that workforce. You go to any NASA field center or any one of these big companies or SpaceX, and you talk to people, you're going to get a pretty even blend of either Star Wars and Star Trek or the Apollo program, some younger ones, the shuttle. And it was a real inspiring thing in a way that nothing else, you don't hear people say, yeah, I got engaged in space because I was inspired by, you know, my uncle's work for the IRS or something like that. It's just not the way you find people getting into to STEM fields. But spaceflight seems to have a real magic to it that few other things do. And that's kind of what I was trying to encompass in that answer, talking to people's hearts while still giving a sufficiently rational answer to appeal to their minds.
You know, years and years ago, I was doing one of the shows, and this subject came up of why space. And I gave an answer, and it was only so-so received by the people. And I hurried out. It was an afternoon show, and my son had a short film. My older son had a short film in the Tiburon Film Festival at the time. And the Tiburon Film Festival, and it didn't have anything to do with space, by the way. The Tiburon Film Festival was all save the world, kind of do good, kind of humanity-saving films, okay? So there was a film about feeding poor people, and the networks around the San Francisco Bay Area for how homeless and poor people are distributed food and what that distribution system is like. And then there were a couple of others in the same vein. One was about prisoners doing something for humanity. I forget what it was. But then they took question and answers, and a question came up out of the audience and said, why aren't we spending more money on these programs? And there were a couple of speakers speaking, and they said, well, you know, the government thinks other things are important, like going to space, but we shouldn't be doing that. We should be spending money on all these programs needed for people here on Earth and here in the Bay Area to feed people who really need to be fed and not going to space. And they took one or two more questions. So I did go up and talk to the person who made that comment. And they're all real young. I mean, you know, I probably look like Grandfather Time to them. And, you know, I said, you know, you're talking about distributing food, growing food, agriculture and all this. Do you understand what increases and how the increases in food production happen so that you can better do some of the things that you're talking about and how you can better refine distribution systems? Do you understand the role of being in space and how that works? And they walked away from me. So,
wow.
So obviously I wasn't speaking to their heart.
Right.
I've told the story before on the space show. I just thought of it, you know, but, yeah. It is, listeners, it's not easy to say why space is important and valuable to people who are not space people. It really isn't. And to say we've got to save Earth because we're going to get whacked by an incoming someday doesn't work. And to say some of the other traditional things about, you know, humans have got to explore or we'll perish, it doesn't work. It's honest to God, it is not an easy question to answer for people who are not engaged and knowledgeable about space or the space industry or how our economy works, because actually our economy right now is 100% dependent on space because of timing. So whether that's an educational flaw or a failure of the space people to properly communicate, I don't know. But I saw it in your book, and I thought, well, maybe Rod has the answer.
And well, I had a couple of partial answers, I think, that were, I hope, woven into a whole. But, you know, I also had a little bit of help with this, because when I was pitching the book and I had a number of publishers interested, and we were very close to the finish line in terms of getting the commission going, but there was this concern about risk reduction. So I finally turned to the National Space Society, which I'd been working with for years. You know them well.
Right.
And sponsor the show. And I said, would you be interested in helping underwrite this? So Stan Rosen, who is a stalwart and longtime former leader in that organization, said he'd take that on, and did a lot of heavy lifting to help raise the funds to get this thing done. So it was a co-publication deal, but that also meant, of course, that, and I would have had access to them anyway, just by virtue of being a member and being involved, but it gave me enhanced access, I'd say, in terms of being able to talk to people from there and interview people from there and get dialogues going, because there's a lot of people in that organization that know an awful lot about this subject. And what is their stock and trade? A big part of it is talk of the public about why all this stuff matters, about why space settlement is important and why we think it can be done and so forth. So where NASA kind of has this restriction in the pipeline in terms of what they can say about themselves, because it's really not part of their charter to spend a whole lot of money on public relations. It's just something that they do, public relations and education. Something like the NSS and other groups like the Planetary Society and so forth on the robotic side are kind of the inverse of that. That is their reason for being, and so that makes that really very helpful and very handy. So that was an incredible leg up. And one more thing, and this has nothing to do with the NSS, but having that conversation you're talking about, I mean, it's almost easier to talk to the Apollo deniers sometimes than people that are just kind of middle of the road, because at least they're passionate about something. In their case, since we never landed on the moon, Stanley Kubrick faked it and all that. And you may not make any headway in terms of changing their point of view, but if they're talking, if they're just asking about, you know, obviously we built the rocket and they flew somewhere. And this part, you got to accept no matter who you are, what history you embrace. And if you're talking about the economics and the money spent on this, yeah, I mean, there was that same argument in the 60s as there is now about we should be filling potholes and rebuilding bridges and feeding the poor and giving out more foreign aid and so forth. And, you know, there's some merit to all those programs in the right place, the right amount. But then you look at something, as I did in the book, and I kind of gritted my teeth a little bit because I felt kind of odd writing it. But you look at something like the F-35 program, and we're somewhere north of $350 billion on that. That figure is a couple of years old. That's a lot of Apollo programs. That's a lot of NASA yearly budget. That's like 15 years of NASA money. And you think, well, what did we get for our money? And I think what makes the new space age so exciting to me, this space 2.0 phenomenon, is that they're changing how they do business. I mean, NASA has always had private companies or publicly owned companies building their hardware for them, but they're doing it a different way now. It's not the old school cost plus contract, you know, whatever overruns are there, as long as they can be rationalized somehow will go. It's the way it's being done by SpaceX and Blue, and now the pre-existing contractors like Northrop Grumman and Boeing, who are starting to come around and say, okay, you know, this is a survival game and we got to figure out a new way of doing business, and it's a lot more efficient.
You have a caller that you have been keeping on hold because you've been talking so much.
I do. I talk way too much.
That's right. So I'm just pulling your leg. Let me turn on the caller.
But you're right, actually.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our show. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you very much for calling.
This is Marshall in Renfro. I was talking to some junior high school kids a couple of weeks ago, and I took off talking about the Apollo program and so on, and one of the kids went, I wonder why Harry Potter hadn't gone to the moon. And your conversation earlier kept touching on that. There's some people that you just, you know, you're shooting missiles over their head and they don't even hear them. How do you handle that?
Well, wait a minute. What did you say about Harry Potter going to the moon? I want to know what the answer is.
I told them Hogwarts was in England.
Well, but they can still go to the moon from England.
Yeah, well, the problem is a lot of these people think
the British space program.
British space program. Oh, I wish I'd have thought of that one. A lot of people just think the Saturn V rocket was, you know, some kind of magic hocus pocus, and it came into existence, and they don't understand that, you know, there's engineers designing this stuff. It's technically hard.
I thought it came out of a Cracker Jack's box. Isn't that where you got all of this from?
Got it out of Wernher von Braun's Cracker Jack's box. Okay.
Dr. Cracker Jack's. Yeah, I mean, I have to admit myself, when I am working on one of these books and I'm spending months and months full time kind of pawing through these materials and reading references and looking at photos and occasionally watching documentaries and so forth, the further we get from the Apollo era, it's almost harder for me to believe that it ever happened. And I was there. I was alive then. So I was talking, I may have told this story on the show before, David, and if I did, I apologize, but I was talking to a group of of aerospace engineering students a few years ago, and it was a small group, really nice kids, and I, as I will do, you just saw me do it here, I got kind of carried away and was talking about this incredible time where missions were leaving the Earth as often as every 2 months or 10 weeks for the mountains and valleys of the moon to do these amazing explorations, and what a great time it was, and all these things were happening, and we could watch most of it on television live and so forth. And a couple of the kids down the front row started crying. They were sobbing. I stopped them. I kind of wandered down there. I said, I'm sorry. Was it something I said? I didn't mean to upset you. And one of the girls looked at me and said, you have no idea how lucky you were to be alive then. I was born in the middle of the shuttle era. And while we loved the shuttle, it was nothing like what you saw. And I was kind of dumbstruck. I thought, wow, you're right. And that had gotten the story across. But again, this is talking to the heart as well as the mind, maybe a little more of the heart, the case, because I was jumping up and down and waving my arms a lot. And I think that's an important part of this communication process. I don't know if that had answered the Harry Potter question, but it does resonate with young people, especially if you can do it in kind of a compact and concise way, which is a little more challenging for me because I do like to talk a lot. But if you can compile this stuff in a form that they find convenient and enjoyable to digest, then you really got something powerful there.
Mm-hmm. Marshall, did the people that you talked to know what Apollo was? I mean, did they at least have that much knowledge about it? What did you find out?
They basically were slightly better than, oh, people went to the moon. You know, they've seen the video clip, they saw Armstrong getting off and Buzz Aldrin, you know, walking around, and a couple of the other ones. They knew that there was more than one mission to the moon. But that's about it. And, you kind of wonder about the education system if it's that bad.
I don't wonder about it. I know about it.
Well, I tell you, though, I don't think any of those kids are going to get through this year and the media deluge that's coming without knowing a lot more about it. And I confess, I haven't seen the new Apollo 11 documentary that was released in the theaters a few weeks ago. I worked on another one that Nat Geo produced that is different. It's the whole program. It's not just Apollo 11. But I haven't seen, so I've seen that because I was working on it, but I haven't seen the one that was recently
it's
released.
It's amazing, Rod. You really need to see it.
Brave.
Yeah, you need to see it. It's amazing. And I've taken some non-space folks to it, and they kind of went dragged and had to be dragged and sort of coerced to go to it. They didn't think it would, and they were older people. They were my age, and they were really blown away by it. So
I've heard young people who'd had maybe moderate marginal interest in that era have told me, either written or in person, that they had seen it and were sobbing. It was so powerful to them. And I thought, great, you know, this is exactly what we need. It's a little more powerful to see it on the big screen, I think, for this generation than to read it, perhaps. But if that works, by golly, you know, please go on and do more of them. And we need more Tom Hanks, too, because he needs to make another Apollo piece.
That was fun. Anyway, talk to you next time.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thanks.
Listeners, the line is available, but I'm going to pause and take us to break because we're marginally beyond our break point. I do answer the phone during the break. We'll be gone about 2.5-3 minutes. The phone number, if you would like to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. And email remains drspace, drspace at thespaceshow.com. And we are talking to Rod Pyle, our most prolific space author for 2019. The book we're talking about, Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners are Creating a New Space Age. Everybody, stay where you are, and we'll be right back with Rod.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Tuesday Space Show program for the first Tuesday in April. It's actually April 2nd. It's my dad's birthday, if he were alive, back from the late 1880s. And it's another good friend of mine's birthday as well. We do have sponsors for this segment. So the Space Development Network is a sponsor. Would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? I see everybody out there is raising their hand. Thank you for that. This network, the Space Development Network, is an online organization allowing you to join together with others to advance the plan for space development. They're looking for a wide variety of people with interest and skill. It's a free network to join, and you can get all the information you need about it at developspace.info. Okay, and this is Doug Plata. He will be at ISDC, and if you want to talk to him about it, I'm sure you will have no problem finding him. Celestis is a sponsor, and once again, they are still the only proven pioneer service provider for Memorial Spaceflight Services in the world. And launching your loved one or a symbolic amount of their ashes or DNA into space is very powerful, and it's very meaningful. And I have done it three times, and it's very moving, and it's a great closure. You can launch from New Mexico on suborbital, or the Cape for orbital, or Vandenberg orbital. They will soon be going to the moon, and hopefully in the near future, deep space and possibly on to Mars. Again, I've done three flights with my mom and my two dogs, and my kids were with me, and it was incredible. And Celestis is an amazing company with people who are just really, really superb. As I keep saying, it's one of the best business I've ever dealt with, and it's pretty hard to say that about a funeral business. You usually don't think about that. But if you want more information, it is Celestis.com, and you can include a little bit of your DNA with your loved one and make the symbolic flight with them if you're interested. I wish I had thought about doing that. I would have gone with Mom and the two dogs, especially to the moon. In addition, the National Space Society is a sponsor, and they have great events, including ISDC coming up in early June in the Washington, D.C. area. Rod Pyle, our guest today, will be there, and if you want to meet him, this is a great opportunity for you to meet this incredible, prolific author who is really a great guy, great sense of humor, and knows the industry backwards and forwards, and you should have him in your contacts list. So, again, if you go to NSS.org, that website will work. And ISDC is plastered all over the front of the website, and you can go there and make your arrangements and plan on going. And I will be there, and I look forward to seeing all of you there. If you want to meet up with me, because it's usually very crowded, if you email me, I will be happy to give you my cell phone so you can text me or try to find me while I'm there. But I do wear Space Show logo wear clothing, so I'm probably the only one there doing that, so you should be able to find me. Also, the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us. And this is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring. And you can see how the technologies and destinations build upon one another. On the web version, you can explore hundreds of individual elements in a lot more detail. Their website is thespaceplan.com, all one word. You can buy your own copy of it. It comes in two terrific versions. It's inspiring, especially if you have kids. And Jay will be back with us on the Space Show in a couple of weeks to talk about it. He will likely be at ISDC, although I don't know that for sure. He's very active in NSS, and he may very well be there this year. But again, check it all out at thespaceplan.com. So we're back to talking to Rod Pyle, and his book is Space 2.0. And first of all, Rod, are you planning by chance to be at Space Access in the middle of this month?
I don't think so, because I have this year three different publicists working at the same time, and it got very busy very quickly. So I was talking to Dave Gressler, who's another NSS guy, about going, and I just don't think I'm going to be able to get the time carved out. And as you know, by the time you end up going to 7 or 9 or 14 conferences in a year, your credit cards are racked up pretty high, so you kind of have to start choosing your targets. By the way, for people who are interested in ISDC and the NSS, the new website is space.nss.org. They changed the URL.
Yeah, but the old one works fine, and it's shorter. So
it does, but then you might have to look at the old website. We certainly want people looking at the new one. I think we should get a bunch of your listeners together and just take over the bar at the Arlington Sheraton when we're there. We'll hold court.
Well, if I find them and they let me know that they're there, or they somehow connect with you and let you know, I'm staying at the hotel, so why not? So I look forward to it. It would be fun.
Have you been to that hotel before, by the way?
No, I've never have been to that hotel before.
Okay, I haven't either. I have heard it's a little smaller than what's been used in the past, so it'll probably be a slightly more intimate experience, but the nice part of that is people aren't spread over to such a big area, so we get to keep bumping into each other and
yeah, maybe
rejuvenating our conversation.
Maybe, and we can ask Greg Autry about that. He's coming on a week from Tuesday, right before I leave for Space Access. He'll be our guest. So
that'll be fun.
And he wants to talk about ISDC as well. So in reading your book, Space 2.0, you have a couple of things that stand out. So first of all, you have a chapter devoted to space entrepreneurs, and then you have a chapter devoted to the space entrepreneur, SpaceX, and then Blue and ULA don't get a full chapter, but they get to sort of share with one another. Just how important to private space flight and creating a new space age has been SpaceX, Blue, Virgin, and the revised ULA, because Torrey has really turned ULA on its head and made it competitive, or as competitive as you can make with that company.
He has, and he was another person I interviewed, and it was a real pleasure doing it. I don't think that ULA would have reinvented themselves, at least not at the pace that they've done so, were it not for SpaceX. And the only reason that those three companies didn't each get a separate chapter, well, for one thing, as I said, I wrote long and had to do editorial triage. And I had a wonderful editor named Jim Lauder, who had a welcoming handshake with his right hand and a claw hammer with the left hand, and got me through the manuscript and made it much, much better than it was. So I appreciated his efforts, and one of the difficult decisions was, you know, who gets how much airtime. But the thing about SpaceX is, as wonderful as Blue Origin is, for example, I find what Bezos is doing and why he's doing it and how he's doing it very inspiring. I mean, besides the fact that the guy puts his money where his mouth is by investing $1 billion of his own money every year into his own company, some people would call it his space hobby, I suppose, he's really got the right ideas in his heart in the right place to make this happen, and I have tons of admiration for him. They just haven't done that much yet. You know, they've done a lot of hard development. They've been around longer than SpaceX by 2 years. They started in 2000. They've done amazing things. I mean, they've got this big, very powerful rocket engine, the BE-4, which they're actually going to be selling to their competitor or co-opetition, however you want to put it, ULA, which I think is yet another sign that things are changing big time. And a lot of stuff's happening there. And the New Shepard, of course, is still in test flight. But when you see how much SpaceX did in a short period of time with private investment, and Steve Jurvetson is half of another chapter because he put together a lot of money for SpaceX in their darker hours in 2008, 2009, you just can't help but be incredibly inspired. And arguably, I think, and this is a very subjective judgment on my part, I think at least for the public, the real turning point for this new space age and the whole space 2.0 conversation has been coming for a while, but in so many ways, I found the launch of the Falcon Heavy to kind of be that marker. You know, okay, we're here. You know, this possibly this really eccentric, very wealthy guy said, I want to build rockets, and I want to build really big rockets, and I want to go to the moon and Mars, and I want this, and I want that. And if I make money, that's okay, but that's not my primary driver. And a lot of people doubted that. But that thing launched on the appointed day at the appointed hour. How often do you see that, especially with a maiden flight? So I thought that just changed everything in terms of perception for the public, especially.
I have an email question for you, okay?
Okay.
Bob is in Philadelphia, and he said, since you're citing the Falcon Heavy as a turning point, I wonder if the Falcon Heavy would be that turning point were it not for the bad processing and horrible handling and delays involved with the government vehicle, SLS, as well as Orion. They certainly make SpaceX and Falcon Heavy look great. Had that not happened, would Falcon Heavy still be a turning point?
I think so, because there was no way we were going to get a Saturn V plus rocket out of NASA and Boeing in a whole lot less time than we're seeing it. Could it have happened faster? Yeah. Would it have ever been anywhere near the cost effectiveness of SpaceX? I don't think so. And it certainly isn't going to be. You know, I'm sure you've had lots of conversations on the show about it. Best guesses from people in the know seem to be they're going to fly out their manifest, you know, probably ten flights max, go through the shuttle engines they've got, a few more for the primary core, and then it's kind of touch and go whether it's going to continue, because at that point you've got these private operators, assuming that things work the way we expect them to with Blue and SpaceX, which isn't necessarily a given. But by NASA's own internal studies, you've seen them. These companies are doing the work at anywhere from a half to a tenth the price of the old way of doing business. So it's just really hard to look at this old process of big, expensive, expendable rockets versus these newer, leaner, cheaper operations with reusable rockets and see that there's any other path ahead. But specific to the question, it's certainly threw the Falcon Heavy at the sharp relief, and I think the whole SpaceX lineage all the way back to the early launches in the first part of this decade, sure.
You have another phone call. Let me see if I can tell you who it is. Not from caller ID. Hold on. Good evening, caller. Thank you for calling. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Martin from Dallas, Texas, calling in. Thanks for taking the call, Dr. Livingston.
Thank you very much. Good to hear from you, Martin.
Well, I had a question for your guest, Rod, tonight. And
go for it.
I wanted to. Well, first, congratulations on I guess the third book. Actually, Amazon told me it's being shipped, so it's actually coming in first on the moon.
So it's not taking that mysterious 2 months that they were estimating at one point, I hope.
I guess they, yeah, well, that's another story. Space 2.0, just to let you know, that for especially somebody like myself that's been around for a long time, it's a very inspiring book to read because it's so easy to get jaded on what's happened over the last couple of decades. And, you know, the hope it gives, the positive outlook on where we should be and inevitably will be in space. It's just congratulations on the writing on that. It really put a sense of hope back in some of us that just really quit reading about these things, to be honest.
Well, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I want to thank you for saying that. And I have to make a confession, which this will be my first public confession of this, David Livingston.
Yes.
Which is, as I was starting this book, I had this little nagging fear of, you know, I'm a little jaded by nature. I think a lot of us that grew up during the space race and watched things, you know, contract to Earth orbit and slow down and budgets drop and aspirations drop in some ways, have gotten a little jaded. You know, some of us call ourselves children of Apollo's children, all that kind of thing. I'm not necessarily part of that cadre per se, but I was concerned about feeling a little jaded about this, and I thought, I wonder if I have to fake it a little bit, is that going to be okay? And as I got into the project and was talking to more and more people, and they were across the spectrum too. Some of them were incredibly optimistic and had very powerful visions of the future, like Steve Jurvetson, who's just an amazing person to spend time with, big money investor in space. And some people were a little more jaded, a little less optimistic. Not rolling any names out, Dave Livingston. No, I'm just kidding. But I found it in those conversations, even in the ones where we were kind of comparing notes about some of the darker hours, I was getting really revved up and excited and optimistic, and it became this organic process of, hey, this really is going to happen. And this was, the bulk of this was done before the Falcon Heavy launch. I had to update the book afterwards, which is another conversation about what a fast-moving target this is. But I thought, this really is real. This isn't another one of those false dawns or false alarms. This is really happening, and there's money going into it, and there's revenue being generated, there's processes happening that are going to make all this much more affordable and dynamic than we've seen in a long time. And thank God I can write about it from an honest core position, and that was really, really a pleasure. So I'm sorry, Martin, please continue.
Oh, no, that was the feeling. I mean, yeah. You know, that's the feeling. Actually, kind of a little aside before my question, if you read your book, Space 2.0, in conjunction with another book I read that gave me a sort of the other side, The Space Barons, about Bezos and...
Well, that's from a few years ago. I had that guy on the show.
Really? I was thinking, I think it's from last year, actually.
The Space Barons, isn't that from the Washington Post reporter?
It may be. I cannot remember the name.
Or am I thinking of something different? But I thought I had him on the show. Huh?
Yeah, it was definitely published in 2018, the one I'm thinking of. And it's wonderful because it talks mainly about Bezos and Elon Musk and some Richard Branson for color. And it gives that, you read it and you think, oh, this is battling whatever, but really it's more of a hopeful book, and it's sort of rod, it's that, you know, it's that fleshing out of the parts of that where you talk, and you finish it thinking, wow, how's this going to end? this is going on.
Let me say something, because it was by Christian Davenport,
and he's
a leading journalist with the Washington Post, and I remember asking him is he comfortable writing all of this with Bezos owning the Washington Post? And we kind of had a laugh about all of that.
Well, that is a good question.
But, you know, he's looking at Musk and Bezos and some of these other players kind of from the outside looking in. I mean, he does know space, and he is knowledgeable about all of this. But Rod lives this, and he is in it, and he sees these people, and he talks to these people, and he's... You should see him work a crowd, and you know, and he's on panels,
and he,
you know, there is a huge difference. This is what we were talking about very early on, why space and why a space person can make the case for space to any space audience, any place on the globe. I mean, yeah, that, it's not an issue. But take it to the general public, and it's really an issue. So what does this guy see? He sees all the weird behavior with Musk and all the crazy stuff he did on Joe Rogan's show or this or that or his Tesla crap or, you know, and, you know, he sees the issues with, you know, Bezos and, you know, Amazon and the government. And it's a different way of looking at the same coin. And I'm not saying the Space Barons is wrong or anything like that. I think people should read all of it and have all of these perspectives to consider.
Yeah, well, it felt like a good balance, but I guess
different.
I should get to my question, Ron.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Very, very simply, and it's funny, after reading these things, and your perspective, knowing the things you do, seeing what you've seen, when do you have a time projection, months from now, years from now, whatever, when we're going to see a humaned crew launching in an American-made spacecraft into orbit?
Oh man,
is that a dumb question, or is that?
No, that's people right there.
I'm serious. I mean, I read all this and I hear it, and you know, is the first time going to be when they're setting up the. You know, the nuclear missiles on the moon for Space Force, or?
So wait, are you talking about for instance, SpaceX delivering crews to the ISS?
Anything that where you're launching people in an American-made spacecraft into orbit, to the space station in orbit.
It's going to be an interesting moment because I kind of suspect that the Russian space program is going to, human spaceflight program is going to slow to a crawl. Because at least the rough estimates I've been able to get from folks in the engineering side is the money, $83 million now per seat in the Soyuz is an appreciable percentage of what it costs to launch that rocket. And without that, I think they're going to be in very bad shape. So, you know, from what I'm told, and at this point, same stuff you read, I don't have a whole lot of hot inside tips, later this year for SpaceX and hopefully later this year for Boeing. And then 2020, it becomes somewhat routine, but fingers crossed on that one, right? But, I mean, we all want to see it, because this gap between the shuttle and now was so much longer than anybody wanted or planned for. And I remember when they announced they were going to shut down the shuttle program, and Armstrong and Cernan and those guys from the Apollo years got up and said...
Yeah, broke that note to Congress.
Yeah, this is not a good idea. We really want you to think this through. There's a whole bunch of reasons we don't agree. And they were, I think, righter than a lot of us thought. And it's been a long, long haul. But admittedly, part of it is that it took a while for the commercial people to get the funding they were promised, too.
Right. Well, I know it's kind of a coin flip to figure it out, but I keep waiting. Well, anyway. I appreciate it, Rod. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Dr. Livingston. I have watched Rod work a crowd. I've seen women swoon. It's really...
Now, wait a minute. What did I miss?
It's really amazing.
What did you do in the space? Are you retired, or do you work in the industry?
No. I'm just a fanboy like so many people raised during the Apollo era and watched them walk on the moon. So
what is it, Rod?
So modest.
What are you saying, Rod?
He's a trained engineer. He's being modest.
Well, I am an engineer. That's true, but... but I've followed a lot of that all the years, and actually had the wonderful opportunity to talk with Rod, and maybe even do a little work with him. So I have an enormous amount of respect for the man.
Rod, is that the police car coming to take you back?
Sorry about that. Yeah, somebody decided to trigger their alarm outside the window. I got to get a real studio one of these days, you know. Embarrassing when the dogs start barking.
I've got a guy where I live down the street who practices on the drum Sunday during my Sunday space show. So I don't know if it comes across on the space show, but boy, do I hear him pounding the damn drums for 2 hours while I'm doing my show on Sunday. So
I've always envisioned you in a very professionally designed studio with foam that costs $1,000 per square inch and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
is that the case?
I wish. No.
Acoustically perfect room.
That is not that is not the case. Anyway, we all have our fantasies, don't we? Martin, thank you very much for your call.
Thanks, Martin.
Good to hear from you.
Talk to you again.
So, listeners, Martin has cleared our line. If you would like to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223, and there is still plenty of time to take your call, and we would appreciate hearing from you. What about the role of all of these small entrepreneurial companies? I mean, every time, like I look at the list of who's speaking at Space Access, and there's all these small entrepreneurial companies, you know, most of us probably never heard of most of them, and they're doing this or that with imaging, or this or that with 3D printing, or this or that. It seems like the access barriers are really low because there is money, they can get money, and they're springing up everywhere with young engineers, young scientists, young business people, maybe some not so young, that see a niche for something that they believe they can make money on, and it's a space business. And it just seems to be growing like a wildfire.
It's really exciting, and part of what I enjoy, I work at JPL seasonally, so I'm not a full-timer up there, but I write a book for them, or have written a book for them for the last few years about their technology highlights for that year. And it's meant to be a layperson accessible, although it goes to a very, very restricted audience of people at NASA headquarters and so forth. But part of what's so fun about that is talking to these people. And these are, you know, they've got doctorate degrees in engineering and physics and so chemistry and so forth. They're maybe 28 years old and way smarter at that age than I will be when I die. And they're talking about their projects. And part of it that is such an enabling factor for this is the miniaturization of components, the more standardized and off-the-shelf nature of these components, the reduced power requirements that they have, and the enhanced capability and better AI capability and better programming and all this stuff, meaning that they're cheaper to make and cheaper to launch because they're smaller, and you can do them in larger fleets because they're inexpensive, and they can send a bunch of them up with one launch. At this point, it's mostly orbital, but stuff I'm talking about would go out to the outer planets, for instance. And that's really inspiring. So now we're seeing that leaking down to the civilian side. We're able to build a spacecraft around something at the level of an iPhone processor or the Raspberry Pi if it's doing basic functions. And if you launch 50 of them, if only 12 of them end up lasting more than a year, who cares? You just launch more.
Well,
that's kind of the idea behind what Musk is doing with OneWeb. Not OneWeb. What's his version of that called? The broadband initiative.
Yeah. Well, look at SpaceIL. They're about to land on the moon.
Yeah, I hope so. Last I checked, they have a little trouble, but they pulled out of that, right?
They pulled out. As far as I know, they pulled out of it. I'm trying to get them on the show, but I guess it's going to wait until after their landing or their attempt at landing. But, I mean, that's within the range of a real private entrepreneurial startup out of this country to boot, and they got there on a Falcon 9.
Yeah, and so this is kind of the other side of what I was talking about, I guess, that not only can you do things less expensively and less massively and with less commitment in terms of huge amounts of dollars, but as you said, we started the conversation, those dollars are starting to become available because people are beginning to say, you know, on the one hand, you've got a smaller amount coming from outfits like Space Angels, which seems to be a great bunch. I don't have that kind of money to invest, but the people I talked to there for the book were very engaging and interesting. And then on the other end, you've got guys like Steve Jurvetson, who are the big money investors, who are incredibly visionary and very smart about what they do and are making that money available to companies like Planet Labs and the people that are coming in behind them. And as I think you were sort of getting at the beginning of this part of the conversation, now we've got college students and university labs and people working out of their homes. And the only hard part for me, particularly because I edit Ad Astra, the magazine,
is sometimes trying to parse out what's real and what's wishful. And sometimes, you know, it used to be that, that most of it was wishful thinking, especially in the nascent new space area, and very little of it was real. Now it's a little harder to tell because that, that membrane between the two is getting pretty permeable, and it's hard to tell.
Absolutely. What stands out for you in Space 2.0?
Oh, gosh. I think the thing that really occurred to me as I was framing it up and then working through it was, how do you find, how will we find as a society globally, first starting domestically and then globally, this sweet spot where we combine the best efforts of NASA, which is still and will for some time be the leading national space agency on the planet, and the private sector, companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, the United Launch Alliance, Northrop Grumman, and so forth, and their various ways of being private or capitalistic. And then international suppliers, both government and private. You know, where is this perfect overlap between these three fields where we get the maximum bang for our buck? We're seeing increasingly that it's difficult for NASA to continue to design and build or contract out major hardware, and it makes an awful lot of sense for them to buy that from suppliers. But they will always have a role, I think, I hope, as leaders in science and aspirational engineering, in big idea missions and projects that may not make economic sense for a long time. Then you've got the private providers we've been talking about, like SpaceX and Blue and ULA, who will continue to provide launch services for ever lower amounts of money and more frequency and more safety and more reliability, I think, although their reliability is already really good. And then that kind of big question mark as I was trying to finish the book was, what happens to the international sector? China is this real wild card. You know, we had thought we had a pretty good handle on where they were heading and what they were doing, but a couple times a year now, it seems like when they actually deliver the news about what's happening, it's a little earlier than we expected. Possibly more successful than we expected, depending on what your expectations were. So are we going to partner with them, or are we going to get into this space race, which when Pence made his Moon by 2024 speech the other night, I think I have to say I was a little disturbed with this idea, and I think it was a tactical decision about getting people motivated, but do we really want to be in another space race with China, and where does Russia actually stand in this? Militarily, I get it. But on the civilian side, I don't quite see it. Not yet, anyway.
Well, it's possible that that question may be answered more by China than by us. So one has to be open to that possibility. It's a question I'll ask Dr. Goswami the next time she's on the show, a person who you introduced to the space show, and I thank you very much for that.
Absolutely, and be sure to talk to Greg Autry about it, too, if you're going to be nearing that subject, because he just had an article come out in Foreign Policy, I think it was today, talking about the Chinese program and very specific things on the military side, a lot of which I didn't know much about.
Do you have the article?
Yeah, I can send you a link to it.
Yeah, if you can, because I would have that available before he's on the show in a week. That would be helpful.
Yeah. You want to talk about a writing machine. He doesn't put out as many books as I do because he's got this little job being a full-time professor at USC, but he is really, really prolific on the periodical side and puts out a lot of material both on Forbes and these other outlets. It's all extremely well-researched and very high-level stuff.
He's really sharp and very bright, absolutely. Yeah, if you could send me the article or the link to it, I would have it available for talking to him when he's on the show.
Absolutely.
Is there anything that you're approaching this, it sounds like we're doing rah-rah sis-goom-bah for New Space. Yippee, yippee, yippee.
Well,
the downside? Is there a weak link? What do you see as a let's just look at it from all sides? Is there a vulnerability?
Well, let's put up a pro argument for SLS. I'm going to duck right after I say this to avoid the incoming fire. But you know, it's possible. It's extremely unlikely, but it's possible that tomorrow morning Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos wake up and think, you know, this rocket thing is not working out the way I want it. I don't want to do it anymore. Or they go public and they're their board says we're not going to do this anymore, and we're back to the old school engineering practices and costs and so forth. And suddenly, SLS, they could theoretically, I suppose, be the only game in town for a while until the next comer came along. It's extremely unlikely, I think almost impossible at this point, but it could happen. So that's a weak link. I think it is possible also to get ahead of ourselves. I mean, we all know what Elon was talking about at the last couple of IACs before the most recent one about versus the interplanetary transport system, I think, or interplanetary colonial transporter, I guess it was.
Right.
And then, went through these various iterations. And we've learned over time, especially in the media, sort of what kind of discount level to apply to his aspirations, and he's pretty candid about it too now. But it is easy to get a hold of ourselves, and I would not want to see what I think we saw a bit of in the 80s and 90s with what we were calling New Space then, where a whole bunch of money gets pumped into these efforts that just burn the money. It becomes a machine for raising more money by raising money, and you don't see results. And we saw that happen a bunch of times. They may have been well-intentioned in many cases. I think some probably were not necessarily. It's a good lifestyle if you can afford it. And I don't want to see that happen. I'm still very burned up about the whole Mars One fiasco, because I had no questions in my mind from day one when that thing was rolled out that it was a joke. But I did appreciate how much people seemed to put into it. And it did strike a match under a big segment of society. I'm just not sure it was done in the most genuine fashion it could have been. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. So I don't want to see that happen. I want to see this be real, but I think we've kind of cleared that hurdle.
What do you see as a regulatory or a government risk to New Space, or are we beyond that now?
No, I don't think we're beyond that. I think we're, especially on the consumer side, I think we're yet to walk into the thicket. So I know you followed what happened after the last crash of the Virgin rocket plane. And that brought into, I think, sharp light for us, for those of us who may not have been thinking about as much as we should have, the role of the FAA and other federal agencies in regulating this stuff. So if you're talking about NASA, that's one story. But if you're talking about private citizens going up in rockets and rocket planes with a fair amount of risk, at least for the first number of years, how the heck do you regulate that? How much of that can really be discounted and signed off by waiver? And I think that alone is one huge area that's going to be very difficult to properly regulate. But I am heartened a bit by watching what the National Space Council has been doing in terms of trying to sort of speed up some of these processes. You don't want to go too fast and loose, but you also don't want the regulations to be 5 or 10 years behind what's happening. And we see that in media all the time with all the new platforms that come out and privacy concerns of Google and other companies. So I'd like to see New Space move a little faster than that, because we're getting almost as far away from the start of the Apollo program as that was from the Wright brothers. That means it's really time to be moving quicker.
What should we have talked about during the program about either book that we have yet to talk about, or that you would like to say, given that we're at the end of the program?
I really want to talk about is the hundreds of thousands of your listeners that are going to run out and purchase it the second we get off the air, because if that doesn't happen, none of us are going to be writing space books a whole lot longer.
Well, they don't have to run out. All they have to do is go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon and do it. And if they do it through Amazon, do it through one of the Space Show or One Giant Leap portals. But the book will probably be at Walmart and your favorite bookstore within a couple of days. So if you're going to run out, you've got a couple of days to go run out.
I think what I would like to say is I'd like to expand on your idea of meeting some of your listeners at ISCC, since we'll both be there, and maybe suggest, if you want to put it together, that we do a live show from there, if you think that'd be possible.
I don't have the equipment or anything to do it with, so it'd be really
pre-record. Yeah,
you could pre-record it, but even that, I have a small little hand tape recorder that I sit in the lobby and I've interviewed people before, but not where I could do a whole big thing connected to computers and stuff like that. It'd be an enormous amount of equipment to bring with me.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how big the attendance would be. I did it at old Space Access move conferences, and I used to do it at the conferences at the Westin Hotel in Los Angeles about rapid turnaround space. What's it called? I'm forgetting what it is, but I used to do things there. But I could throw the equipment in the trunk of the car and drive it down there. And my engineer is in Fresno, so he didn't mind driving down to L.A. for a couple of days and help me out in setting it up and doing it. So we recorded them and did them at the Westin Hotel and also at Space Access in Phoenix. But I'm flying to D.C., and I'm not going to fly this stuff around the country, so it's just not practical, unfortunately.
Well, in that case, I guess we're just going to have a little party instead, which I welcome.
But and I like setting up interviews for the telephone when I'm back more than I like doing 20-minute interviews, in the lobby of the hotel or someplace where it's quiet with my little portable recorder, but I'll probably take my little portable recorder with me, so I'll have that option if there's like a target of opportunity who's not going to be available for a phone call, but would sit down for 20 or 30 minutes. And you know what? I like to have Space Show listeners sometimes, depending who they are and their expertise level, co-host those little segments with me. So I'll look for you, and if I've got one of those going, I'll see if you want to join in on the interview.
Oh, assume so, absolutely, because I'll give you both a run for your money. That'd be the most fun I've had in months.
So I'll be sure to take my recorders with me for that. But I don't think I'm going to take them to Space Access. But that's a different format program. So.
I was thinking I might take. I've got a couple of smaller studio mics and a couple of clip-ons. I thought I might just take them and an adapter. I've got an adapter box that feeds a bit of the Macintosh that gives you pretty high fidelity signal. So maybe we'll put our heads together and see if we want to do something.
Well, the two I have are radio field interview recorders by Roland, and I forget who makes the other one. So their audio is pretty good, and then I dump it into the computer when I go back into the room. So, and I use two of them. I learned the hard way to always have a backup.
So, I had to, about a year and a half, or how long ago was the Mars Insight landing? I guess it was about a year ago. I interviewed Jim Green. I don't even think it was that long. It was just months. I interviewed Jim Green, and I was using my cell phone, and wasn't quite familiar with the app, and was sitting there turning green, and Sue Carlin, another journalist I know, came up and said, "What's wrong?" I said, I think my phone just burned my whole interview with Jim. It was like 40 minutes. And Jim is a wonderful, gracious guy, but none of us wants to look that stupid that we just had one recorder on us, right? So I thought, oh, God, I'm going through all this retrieval software and stuff. And Sue, being Sue, just walked up to Jim and said, "Hey, Jim, would you mind doing that rod again?" He said, "Sure," because she asked so nicely. So she saved my bacon, but I'm with you, never less than two recordings again.
My humiliating experience was at a Mars Society conference at UCLA, and I was interviewing Scott Horowitz. So many of the listeners won't know who Scott Horowitz is because you don't hear about him all that often, but he was deputy administrator of NASA at one time. And we were in a side room, and when I do these interviews, I usually have people sort of lingering nearby to hear them, you know, and or maybe they're not lingering, maybe they're real close to hear them, and that's fine, I don't have any problem. And I noticed that the one recorder that I had quit working. And I don't know when it quit working, and I was so embarrassed, and I said, "Scott, hold it a minute. Let me see if I can get this going again." And this girl leans over to me and she says, "I've been listening and I recorded it on my little recorder that I use for talks here at the Mars Society conference. Would you like to finish the interview on my recorder, take it to your room and work with it? And then here's my cell phone number and you can give it back to me later today." And she saved my butt. I don't know who she is. I don't remember her name. And it was just a little cheap, you know, cassette recorder that people would take to record something at a conference.
You didn't care at that point, did you?
No, and she had all of the interview, and I was able to edit the volume and clean it up and all of that, and I didn't lose any the Scott Horowitz interview. And I bought a second recorder as soon as that happened, and I carried a ton of extra batteries with me. So I got indoctrinated into the need for backup in a very embarrassing and humiliating way. But fortunately, there was some lady there who saved me, and I wish I remembered her name. I was very appreciative of it.
Well, not to sound like a curmudgeon, but there is a part of me that, I mean, I love digital. It has improved my life immeasurably on so many levels. But when you could actually see the spindles of the cassette recorder moving, that was reassuring. You knew that it was printing.
You knew it was working. That, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But with a chip, there isn't anything moving.
Well, I know. So unless you're watching the counter, and sometimes if you haven't refreshed it recently enough, at least on a cell phone, the counter stops being visible and the screen goes blank and you're assuming it's recording, and then you pick it up at the end of
right, the session. Right, and the view meters will still move even if it's not recording, as long as you have battery power. So,
yeah.
So I learned the hard way, never do an interview without backup. And she saved me, and I wish I could remember her name. I'd be eternally grateful to her, but what can I say? I went over to the UCLA bookstore and bought a patch cable so I could plug it into my laptop, and she saved it. So anyway, and Scott was very, very nice about it, very decent, and later came on the show several times. So
that's great. Well, whoever she was, thank you again for Dave Livingston.
So,
he remembers you to this day.
Anything else you'd like to add? And otherwise, we'll say goodnight.
Yeah, I think that's it. Maybe I'll talk to you again when, let me see if I can do it.
Heroes of the Space Age.
That wasn't quite a reverb. They got the idea.
Absolutely. And listeners, again, we're talking Space 2.0, how private spaceflight, a resurgent of NASA, and international partners are creating a new space age, a must read. And then the historical book, First on the Moon, really impressive, full of incredible pictures and stories. Both of these must-have Rod Pyle books. Rod, and until I get a chance to see you in a couple of months or talk to you again, thank you very much for being on the Space Show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Listeners, that's it. We have Friday regular Space Show and then Sunday open lines. So Dennis Wingo is on Friday, everybody, so you want to tune in and hear what is on Dennis's mind. He's talking about lunar industrialization concepts. Everybody have a great rest of the evening, and good night from Rod, good night from David and the Space Show, and keep looking up.